Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the September the 11th, 2007. An interesting show coming up. Got Mark Harris, who's the author of a new book, Family Court Hell. He's the bloke in the UK who's most famous for being jailed after waving to his kids. He was his ex-partner repeatedly failed to follow family court orders that he have contact with the children, and so he used to just keep waving at his kids. He was a bus conductor and got arrested as a result of that. That's just one small example of the absolute bastardry of these insane institutions that are being perpetrated, and these human rights abuses that are being perpetrated against men right around the world, and particularly around the Western world. We will also be talking with the organiser in a minute of the Men's Shed. There's a conference coming up on the Shed movement, which is an interesting movement around Australia, basically allowing men to have a space of their own to be able to talk. We've got in the studio with us Ian Purdy, and he'll be playing some of his new music, which is it's some terrific songs coming out. And as well, we've got Greg Anderson. He's a bit of an academic expert on men's issues. And myself, John Stapleton. So welcome to the show.
Good morning, John. Yes, welcome to you too.
And first up, a father of three was wrestled to the ground by police and locked up for 22 hours without access to his lawyer after crossing the road incorrectly during the recent APEC meeting.
A heinous crime, obviously.
Crossing the street.
Crossing the street. Jaywalking, I believe they call it in most jurisdictions.
Very, very, very bad. Greg McClay said he had been strip searched and spent a night in a city police cell with an ice addict. Mr. McClay has three children, George, 11, Isadora, 3, and Cordella, 6, broke down as they've told of the trauma and being handcuffed and led away in front of his son. 52-year-old accountant from Sydney's North Shore said, "I was just crossing the road. The worst thing is this, happening in front of my young son. You want your children to grow up respecting the police, but how can they when they see this kind of thing?" And, of course, the whole of Sydney has been in lockdown during the APEC meeting, and there's been massive criticism that the police were too heavy-handed. On the other side of the equation, what if something did go wrong? What if someone did take a pot shot at George Bush or...
Yes, well, the irony of that situation with the accountant is, of course, that he was doing somebody's tax return. So he was actually in the employ of the government, making sure that they got their money when he was going off to lunch with his 11-year-old son when he was wrestled to the ground for no reason that anybody in this studio can rationally accept as being reasonable.
Now, I think we have on the line Ted Donnelly from the Lane Cove Men's Shed, and he'll be talking about this conference that's coming up today. Oh, not today, this week, sorry. Are you there, Ted?
Yes. Hi,
well,
Ted.
Versus me, you gave me a panic then, didn't you?
Sorry, the technology is... We've still got a studio here that's powered by bicycle power, so, you know, it's...
Right. We ran out of kerosene.
Ted, thanks so much for coming on Dad's on the Air today. Can you tell us a bit about the conference that's happening this Thursday and Friday in Manly? It's the second National Community Men's Sheds conference. Actually, first of all, why don't you start off by telling our listeners who don't know about Men's Sheds what they're all about?
Well, Men's Sheds are usually workshops where men come together in a social community group. A lot of them do woodwork, some do metalwork, some gardening, all sorts of things are done. Some do mentoring of children and older people. So there's a whole range of different things, but the whole point really is what they're doing is really the excuse for coming together rather than the reason. So they're workshops where blokes come together and do something, basically.
And are these men of all ages, or is it primarily older men, retired men?
Mostly retired men. We have sometimes had younger people in who are in between jobs or for various reasons, but mostly they are retired men. And this is an area where surveys have shown that blokes can get pretty lonely on their own. You know, the job has been a very big aspect of their life, and there's quite a lot of social isolation when people come away from the job, and that's what really started the Men's Shed idea.
Right, fantastic. So tell us a bit about what's happening in Manly this Thursday and Friday.
Well, we've got the conference in Manly. It's up at the College on the Hill, St. Patrick's College. And it really is for the community men sheds. We had the first national conference in Lakes Entrance 2 years ago, and that was very well received. This one, we've now got, when I checked this morning, with 330 delegates coming.
Wow.
So it's going to be quite a big conference. And really, it's split between... We've got things going on for the blokes in the sheds, practical aspects, and then there's other workshop streams for the coordinators and managers of the sheds, how to get funding and various things like this, the vital parts. And then we've got a stream going on then on the people from the men's health organisations, because they're obviously very interested in how this concept of blokes coming together, how it really helps men, you know, their whole self-esteem and self-worth. So there's a lot of aspects on that that's going on as well.
Okay, so this is not just for professionals or people who are running sheds. This is actually for the guys who attend the sheds coming to this as well, it's both?
Mixture of all three.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, and really, we're still very new. I mean, really, we were a very small group 2 years ago. We've now suddenly shot up to, on the website, we've got 214 sheds now throughout Australia. And this is very rapid, so there's going to be an awful lot of getting together and finding out what we're doing, really.
Right, so most of these 200 or so sheds have sprung up in the last sort of 5 years or something, would you say?
Many of those within the last couple of years.
Wow, so this is really...
It's growing enormously. We've just started up a manual on setting up a men's shed, and we must be getting three or four requests a week from councils or community groups saying, look, we're interested in starting up a men's shed, how do we go about it?
Wow, it's fantastic.
Really, it's growing very, very rapidly.
And is part of this to do with the fact that a lot of men don't have their own shed these days? So some people come to the community shed because...
That was our original idea, that, you know, men, people are now downsizing and people in units or retirement home can't have a shed. But I would reckon that at least half the people in our shed have got one of their own at home. And they're just like... It can be damn lonely in a shed on your own.
Right.
And they like to come together to share what they're doing and chat about the various things and learn from each other. So it's very much this socialising and community. I mean, you know, we get some pretty good laughs in here.
Right. Yeah, so it sounds like a fantastic initiative, and obviously you guys will be sharing a whole lot of tips and ideas and experiences over the course of the conference.
Yep, that's right.
It sounds fantastic, and we wish you all the best.
And incidentally, one that people who are around Manly might be interested in seeing, one of these sheds actually is a mobile shed. It's actually an old Dodge ambulance. And it's up in the northern area of New South Wales, and it goes out on a Monday, it goes to one place, Tuesday out to another. So, in fact, they cover, something like, I think it's about 2,400 square kilometres, and they're bringing the bus down, and it's going to be parked on the seafront at Manly, opposite the hotel there. So I think this could raise quite a bit of interest, so if people are around there, they should pop in and have a look.
What a fantastic idea. So if anyone's, if anyone's in Manly this Thursday and Friday, pop down... Have a look at the mobile men's shed. And
yeah, they'll be very welcome.
And hopefully there'll be some material they can take away if they are interested in trying to get their council to set up a local men's shed in their area.
Yes, absolutely right.
Absolutely.
Choose
fantastic.
The timing right, they might even get a cup of coffee.
Great. Well, Ted, thank you so much for coming on Dad's on the Air this morning, and all the best for the conference.
Okay, and thanks for your interest.
Cheers.
Cheers.
That was Ted Donnelly. He's from the Lane Cove Men's Sheds, one of the organisers of the Sheds Conference that's coming up. Now we go straight to a song. Look, if you want more details of that, by the way, you can look up our website, www.dadsontheair.net. And we've now got a song by Eric Birch. He's the American soldier just returned from Iraq.
Siehe, wir hassen. Wir streiten. Es trennet uns Neigung und Meinung. Aber es bleichet indes dir sich die Locke wie mir.
What happened to my daddy? to survive. On top he behaved him in six subtle ways. It left me confused, so sad yet amazed that I was so blind, brainwashed and taken. For jealous of loathing that my father forsaken. It was all too easy, it was destroyed. The God-given bond we once enjoyed. Alienation or whatever you call it, severed my dad to just a limb with a wallet.
Eric Birch, an American soldier who's returned from Iraq, singing about his experiences over there. We now have on the line Damon. Are you there, Damon?
Yes, I'm here. How are you?
Oh, good. There are a lot of horror stories in Australia about family law, but you're not one of them. You're a bit of a success story. And,
yeah.
Gabby, you've got a 50-50 share of your kids and it's all going well.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
The new laws do work. And I was probably one of the first in Australia to go through the new laws, so it was quite exciting.
Quite hairy
at times.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've just got a truck going past me.
It's all right. It's a beauty to live radio, mate. So, well, we've been a bit sceptical of it all here, I have to say, but you reckon it's all working well? Or it worked well in your case, anyway?
Yeah, it worked well in my case. I mean, I was had about just under 60% care for about 2 years after we separated.
Right.
Then we decided to finalise it and put our divorce through, and the same week the divorce came through, I ended up with two DVOs on me. It's
right.
not quite a normal story.
It is. You don't realise it until it happens to you.
Yeah. So the first one, and I was working with a solicitor at the time, and he just said, look, just accept the DVO, which I didn't want to do. I tried to fight it, but apparently it wouldn't go against me, so we accepted that one without admission of guilt.
Most people advise the exact opposite, that you cannot, under law, make an order unless there's just cause for that, to make that order, and to make an order, a domestic violence order, means that there must have been some cause. So even if you accept it without admission, it's generally seen as the wrong thing to do, but it didn't backfire in your case.
No, well, the first one didn't. The second one that was placed on me, we fought, and that was thrown out of court.
Yeah.
When it did go for the date, when we did have the trial, the judge said, yes, I can see there's a domestic violence order, because they were looking at trying to drag the domestic violence through it.
Yeah.
Just quiz them a little bit more on the domestic violence order and ask them to give specific examples. And then they turned around and said, well, we really can't give you any specific examples. And the judge said, well, even though there's a DVO on you, we've questioned you about it, I'm going to disregard the DVO.
Geez, you were very, very lucky, mate. I think the general advice most experts give is do not accept a domestic violence order against you, even the no admissions thing. It shows up on all your records. You cannot own a handgun or any of those sort of things. You can never get a job in security ever again, and it's there on your record as a permanent black mark. You must have been a violent man if you have a domestic violence order against you.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
It's
one of those domestic violence order, and one of the main terms I was saying is that I was causing her mental anguish and distress trying to fight for my daughter.
That was how you're supposedly being violent to her. Was that's very common and utterly bizarre at the same time.
Yeah. So as I say, the judge saw straight through it. When they went through the whole reading, the court thing, it was daunting. But by that time, I'd changed solicitors about three times. I ended up getting a solicitor that was exceptionally helpful. He basically only deals with families that are in the situation and really supportive to the guys,
right?
Knowing that they get the wrong side of the deal quite often.
Yes, they do.
But no, when we went through there, the opening line that the barrister stated was, she's a great mum, he's a great dad, but Your Honour, the child's the only one that has any rights here. So that sort of set the tone, where they were going in saying, he's violent, he's aggressive, he's a DVO, he's this, he's that, bad parent. And the judges, my barrister that I had, just said, look, just prove it.
Which
don't think there is.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that went through back in February, was the first hearing. And then we had to go to court for the second hearing again in April, where in the interim hearing he set 50-50 as a trial to see how it would go.
Yeah.
Then in April they had 2 weeks to get all evidence that they wanted entered into the case there. They didn't supply any evidence. They turned around and said, look, we don't think we're going to win under the judge, under the new law, so we're happy to sign off now.
Jeez, that's good. I don't think everyone's having such a positive experience. What's been your impression about the whole thing? You think the laws are working, or do you feel like it was a fluke in your case that it did actually work?
Right up until about a week before, I didn't know which way it was going to go. I thought that, you know, they were trying to get me to have every second weekend and every other Wednesday.
Yeah.
The amount of times I almost gave up and accepted it all the way through was more than 100 times in the time frame I was going through it.
And a lot of guys in your position probably would have caved and accepted that, and good on you for fighting on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I put it down. I mean, it wasn't a cheap experience. It cost around the $30,000 mark. Everyone's turning around and saying, well, why would you spend so much money? It's like, well, how much should a car cost? You know, you're going to pay that off in 5 years, and then your children are worth a lot more than a car. So
yeah, absolutely.
If I believe enough in to fight for the cause, which was to look after my daughter and spend time with her, And, you know, even though I didn't have the money at the time, I had to go into debt for it. It was worth every cent.
Now, a lot of people, just on the practicalities of this, argue that, well, the blokes can't really have 50-50 because they're at work, you know. It can only work if mum's sitting around on the dole, basically. She's looking after the kids and you're out there slaving. Whereas it's perfectly possible, isn't it, for both parents to be working and to bring up a kid between them?
Yeah, well, I've actually was exceptionally lucky. I ended up saying to the boss that I worked for at the time, because I'd changed jobs, and I said, I want to come and work for your company, but the proviso is I'm going to work full-time 1 week and 20 hours the next week. So I actually drive my daughter to school, drop her off, and I'm there to pick her up.
Right.
I also take off about 1 or 2 days a week off work, and I do touch-up duties for the school.
Right.
But that was something that I think more than anything, most people would be scared to ask the boss, but I've had three separate employers where I've turned around and said, I can only work 20 hours in this week. My daughter's more important. Most of the employers want to keep you because they realise you're family-oriented, your family comes first, and they believe you're a better quality worker. Now, I'm not saying I am or not.
I'm sure you are. Sound like a really decent soul. So it's working in a practical sense. This is one thing that's often raised against the blokes who want, on the whole, to care for their kids half the time. That's your normal default position for most blokes, I think. Now, but they're often throwing at them that you can't practically do it. But you say it certainly is, particularly with a cooperative employer.
That's correct, yeah. I mean, as well, I haven't been utilising any daycare services myself.
Yeah.
On the weeks that I have my little one.
Yeah, so you save money,
but I know that my ex-wife has her in daycare at least 3 to 4 days a week.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, even if they're going to get the full custody, they'll still realise they want to go back to work and they'll utilise some daycare facilities. I can't see why, I can't see any reason why it can't work if you're doing it for the right reasons, which is obviously to be there with your kids, support your kids, help your kids and be involved in their life.
Oh, it's those early years. They really need the parents, and that's basically all the kid wants is to be with their parents. It's not that complicated, is it?
No. Well, one of the things that, as I say, I was just about to give up. It had been going on. Now, it was only a short case, mine. Again, I was quite lucky there. 6 months, we were in court, out of court, finalised and settled. But about a month before, I was just about throwing the towel. Everything was just getting way too hard. There was, you know, 3 weeks at a time where I wasn't seeing my daughter. She wasn't being returned. And I thought, if I just sign a piece of paper, I'm just going to get to see them. And my daughter, at 4 at the time, turned around and said, Dad, when I get a car, I'm going to drive up and see you more.
Four. good on her. Look, we're running out of time. Just any general advice. It's really heartening, I think, to hear these positive stories. Any just general advice that you would have for other blokes going through what's essentially a pretty rotten time of life?
Yeah. One thing I did have a couple of people tell me. One was my solicitor and one was a very, very close friend that I believe you guys may know, Brian. Both of them gave me the same advice, which I couldn't understand at the time, but it was play the ball and not the player. The ball being the game, the focusing only on what it matters. You go into the solicitor or if you're representing yourself even, is it important to the case? Is it important to the kids? Or is it just costing more money? And just try and stick straight to the same point. Why do you want to be involved in your children's life? You know, which is an obvious answer to that question there. All this other stuff about domestic violence was against her. It wasn't even directed at the children. And it was all just there. I mean, that cost probably $7,000 of money that had no impact in the case whatsoever.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of playing your cards, playing for the right reason, and you've got to believe in yourself that you want the children, you're capable of looking after the children, and you want them to be part of your life as much as they're part of yours.
Right. Thanks so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. That was Damon. He's a young Australian dad who's got 50-50 care of his daughter and a really heartening success story under the new legislation.
Yep. One last thing I would like to say is have complete trust in the new laws because they are there, they are working. I know a few people that have gone through the law and it's actually worked quite well for them. So trust in the law and it will work for you.
Well, we're a little bit more sceptical here, but hey.
That's great.
You're the one that's been through it. Good on you. Okay, thanks so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. We'll be back shortly.
Okay, it's going to play a song. Now, this is a debut of a song that I actually debuted last week with my 12-string guitar here on Dad's on the Air, but we've gone off and recorded it properly. This is Horizon Shine with My Boy, featuring the vocals of Martin King.
Devon, England, with Jolly Stainsby, who's an activist with Fathers for Justice, and also Mark Harris, who's just got a new book out called Family Court Hell. So, both of you, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Hello, nice to be here.
Nice and correct, yes. Yeah.
I might just start off asking both of you just to tell us a little bit about your personal story involving the family court, just in brief, just to let us know what got you involved in Fathers for Justice and in obviously writing your book. Jolly, do you want to just...
Well, to call it brief, it's probably an underestimation of that, because it'll go on and on, but I suppose really it was just the experience of the family courts and the corruption that was involved there. That I suppose really the only way I found was to start, obviously, becoming an activist and to get the message out, to let people realise what's really going on behind the secret family courts.
Right, so in the UK, do you see that as the biggest problem, the fact that everything's behind closed doors and no one really has an idea of what's going inside the courts?
Unless you become a victim yourself, you've got nobody got any idea. And because it's so extreme and so corrupt, people don't actually believe what you've got to say. And so obviously the only way is to publicise it and get the message out there.
Right. So, Mark, you've written a whole book detailing your incredible 10 years,
so 10 years and 133 different court hearings. Yeah, it was the British press called my case, eventually when it was resolved, Britain's worst access case ever. And my marriage.
I'm sure that's not a title you're.
No, I'd rather not have that title, but here we are, we've got it. But back in 94, or into 93, my marriage broke down, and basically my ex-wife became awkward overseeing the kids. And I kept going to court. I had 33 different judges. We had 133 court hearings. The kids were saying they wanted to see me, but Mum didn't want to play the game and comply with court orders. So basically the courts cut me off from the kids and the kids off from me. The case got really extreme, so I wouldn't accept this farce and injustice. I kept going back to court. I started making a public fuss. And eventually I got done for contempt of court in 97 when I got cut off from the kids by the mum. Not the courts, but the mum just refused to comply with the court order. Mm-hmm. They put an injunction on me because I started waving to the kids when she was driving them to school in the mornings. I was on foot, she'd drive by and I'd wave to them just to keep in touch while I was hopefully waiting for the courts to resolve the broken contact order. And she got an injunction to stop me waving. And I said, well, that's really good if she can have an injunction to stop me waving. I've got a contact order you won't enforce. So they took the contact order away and said they'd enforce the injunction on me. I ignored it, carried on waving, and first time around, I got 4 months in prison for waving to the kids.
You got put in jail for 4 months for waving to your own children.
That's right, yep. And I was waving to kids that were waving back and wanted to see me, but the mum didn't want it, and that was the only reason. So the judge cut me off, sent me to prison, and gave me a no-contact order. And I can remember his words clearly, even 10 years on, that he said he was going against the wishes of three intelligent children, aged at the time 6, 8, and 10, who wanted to see their father. And he actually said they had a yearning to see their father. But he said the effect of me seeing the kids on the mother would be catastrophic because she hated it so much. And so he cut me off and banged me up in prison.
It's amazing.
And nonsense, that was the first time.
You would think this was a farce. I mean, you would not believe this was a true story.
It'd make a comedy show.
Right. You couldn't have written a worse script. Really.
This is it, yeah. We used to have a show years ago in Britain called Monty Pythons.
Oh, yeah, we know that. We know them well.
That's it, yeah, where things were absolute farce. Well, you know, we have people doing that. They call themselves judges, but they wear wigs and fancy tights, and they send you to prison for waving to your own kids. And then while they accept the mother's boyfriend's been knocking your kids around and abusing them, and they send him back out to live with the kids and send you off to prison for waving. That actually happened in my case.
Hmm.
And that was just the first time round. Yeah. A couple of years later, we had another contact. Oh, sorry, if you want to...
So you were put in jail for 4 months.
Yeah.
And then what happened after that?
I came out of prison. Kids were still saying they wanted to see me. I still wanted to see them. Eventually, I got another contact order, which the mother wouldn't comply with properly. That eventually broke down after I'd seen the kids for a little while. I'm cutting a lot of stuff out of this long story.
Right.
We went back to court again to get enforcement on the mother, which was quite naive of me, really, when you think the courts don't enforce things on mums. The mum said she wanted me sent to prison because I'd been waving to the kids when she'd been breaking the contact order. So the second judge to do this back in 2001 sent me to prison this time for 10 months because I was breaking the court orders.
Once again, waving.
Waving to the kids and giving them birthday presents outside of contact orders.
Well, you should have thought better to give your own kids birthday.
You don't give your own kids. I could give them presents.
That's a criminal offence.
When I was very occasionally seeing these kids with the blessing of the mother, I was giving them presents. I was buying them like presents that were all right. And that was fine. But because there was an old order from when I weren't seeing the kids to give them birthday presents via the social services, the judge took exception to those presents and not the other presents. He gave me 4 months for that and then 6 months on top for waving. So we got a total of 10 months in prison and off I went. And he also fined me £250 for saying hello to one of my kids in a shop between contact orders. And I said, well, hang on, I've got a contact order that's being broke by the mother. He says, yeah, but if she doesn't comply, it doesn't mean you can talk to them between times. So he fined me. I've never paid the fine, never will. And they've never come after me because of all the publicity.
So whenever you've breached contact orders by doing such horrendous crimes as waving
and buying them presents,
you've been sent to jail, and whenever their mother has flouted the orders, then
they look the other way when she does it.
Right.
Yeah, they just ignore it. They say we can't do nothing, and when you ask for enforcement, one of my ridiculous court orders I got many, many years ago said it was hoped and expected the mother would send the children. So I had this contact order where I was meant to see the kids like 1 o'clock Friday to, say, 6 o'clock Sunday, for example. And then where I said I want it enforced on the mother, they actually wrote on the bottom that it's hoped and expected the mother will comply and send the children. I've still got the court order to this day. It's hideous, yeah. It's Monty Python's. It's, as I said,
of course, the trouble is being held in secret. Nobody believe it.
No,
and they'd always think that the dad's, you know, a troubled dad, or he's caused, you know, there's something wrong with him, or there's some reason behind it.
Yeah,
yeah, or he's making up crazy. These stories. Yeah, he's crazy. He's lost his mind. Yeah,
that's it. But they do it in secret. They couldn't get away with it in open court because people like yourself and the newspapers and that would go there and they'd hear this nonsense about, you know, being sent to jail for giving your kids birthday presents, and it would make the front page of the papers. The judge would be ridiculed and he'd be quietly got rid of. Like in the criminal cases, where you get a judge that does something in Britain that's totally over the top, the press get hold of it, they make a complete nonsense of the judge in the papers, and they don't sack him, but they quietly get rid of him. You never hear from that judge
again.
Shuffle him off. Yeah, he's retired off early, put out the grass, he's sent somewhere where he can't do no harm to the public. But in the family courts, the doors are shut, and they can do what they want. And they're not stupid people, but they're dishonest and corrupt people, these people that run the courts. Mm. And if one does something that's over the top, the others will back it up. They all close ranks, and the next judge and the next judge you go before will all back up what the last one did.
And a cosy club, aren't they?
Yeah, and they can bury the mess under the carpet. Even though the carpet's getting higher and higher, more mess gets buried under there, and you can't legally expose it. That is the major problem.
So how is it that you've been able to tell your story?
Well, in 2001, when this particular judge sent me to prison for the birthday presents and the second lot of waving, I was quite involved in protesting outside judges' homes and courts and that sort of thing.
And this was before the days of Fathers for Justice?
Yeah, it was at the conception of Fathers for Justice. Right. I'd started a little protest group in this part of the country, and when I got sent to prison, Matt O'Connor, who runs Fathers for Justice, took it up and basically developed it into Fathers for Justice. With that's quite a disorganised little protest group. But when this judge had sent me down to prison in 2001... other fathers got together that I sort of helped bring together, and they expanded it, and they protested outside the judge's house. And the judge had 50 or 60 policemen outside the house in riot vans. He knew it was coming, and he had the whole street more or less sealed off so they couldn't get to his house. This is peaceful fathers just going up there with banners and putting letters of complaint through his door. But so the judge then panicked after this protest outside his house, and he was now being publicly ridiculed on the internet and in the papers and in all the father groups. So he went public with reasons why he did this, and he gave a very one-sided and partial reason for it out of his judgment. But of course, once he'd gone public with why he did it, when the case a couple of years later turned on its head and went completely the full circle and I got the kids to come and live with me...
Which we'll get to in a minute.
Which we'll get to in a minute. Because he's gone public with some of it, I can now go public with the rest of it and say, ah, yeah, he said this, but this is what actually happened. And it's the first time ever it's believed in British legal history that you can go inside a family court case and see what happened, and name and shame these appalling people that did this to us. So I have.
Absolutely. And once again, the name of the book is Family Court Hell, and we'll give some details of how you can get your hands on that book at the end of the interview.
Yeah, fine.
Now, apparently you went on a hunger strike at one stage. Is that true?
Well, as soon as I went to prison, I said, right, because I'd got a few fathers. I thought something drastic was going to happen that day in court in 2001, just the way the judge was going and he was praising the mother up when she broke all these court orders and just ignoring all what she had done. So I got a few people in for the committal set. They call it a committal to prison for contempt of court here. And so I got a few, that bit is actually done in open court. So I managed to get a few fathers in there to hear what went on. And of course, they went out and got it on the internet, and that's where all the protests exploded. Basically, we had little tiny protests going on, and when this judge went over the top like this, it sort of ignited what became Fathers for Justice, really.
Mm.
And it all took off from there.
We'll be back with more of Mark Harris and Jolly Stainsby after this track. We'll be right back.
choose. Eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant. Oh yeah, but nothing, nothing can take away this blues. Oh, oh. Without the sun, nothing can stop this lonely rain from falling, falling. Tell me, baby, where did I go wrong?
Talking with Mark Harris, author of Family Court Hell, and Jolly Stainsby, activist with Fathers for Justice.
Continuing with your story, how did it all get resolved in the end? You obviously, two of your kids live with you now, and you're seeing that your third kid regularly. So,
oh yeah,
what's the story of how it all came to be resolved after 10 years?
This is it. Well, it was there was a date that sticks in my mind. It's 23rd of March 2001 when you sent me to prison for the second lot of waving and all that. Exactly 2 years to the day later, two of my kids decided to leave the mother and come and live with me. I hadn't seen them for 2 years. And so what they did is they run away from the mum, basically. They packed all their bags. They organised getting it all out of the house when she weren't there. One of them had got kept my phone number all those years, phoned me up and said, "Will you come and get us?" So I actually went and picked up the kids. The judge had made this little area around the kids' home where I weren't meant to go because they didn't want to see me. And the kids actually phoned me and said, "Will you come to our house, which is in the area, pick up our stuff and bring us to your place?" So I did it. I broke all the court orders, drove in, picked them all up and brought them to my house with all their belongings. Now, this was a Sunday. And of course, the courts are closed. And I've got two kids in my house with all their belongings saying, "We're not leaving."
And we want to live with you, Dad.
Yeah, we're standing with you and we want to live with you. But I've got all these court orders saying because they don't want to see you, you can't go near them or speak to them in the shop even. So I then phoned the Out of Hours Emergency Service. It's an Out of Hours clerk, it's called, at the main royal courts in London. And said, this is the problem. Explained it all to him. I said, I need a judge on the phone and quick. Within 10 minutes, a judge phoned my house up, High Court judge. He asked to speak to the kids. He spoke to the kids for 2 minutes each, got me back on the phone and said, I'll fax you a residence order, removing all the banning orders from speaking to these kids, and I'll get a residence order faxed to my house. Meanwhile, while the fax is slowly coming through my fax machine, two policemen are walking up my driveway and I can see them coming through the glass door. And it's a race, really. Who's going to get there first? These two policemen who's come, obviously recovered the kids, or this fax coming out of the fax machine. And I'm reading through the fax machine as it's coming through to make sure it's all worded right. The doorbell goes. I tear the fax out. Policemen come to the door and they say, we've come to the kids here. And I said, yeah, they're here with me. Right, but they could see them. I said, but here's a residence order I've just been faxed. Go and give that to the mother. So that sent them packing. Off they went. And basically that resolved the case. We had 10 years of absolute hell. It was reported to have cost the British taxpayer £1 million in legal fees, court hearings, judges coming to town, all that sort of thing. And it was resolved by the kids simply taking the law into their own hands. And a 10-minute action.
And a simple fax, yeah.
And a fax. And a fax that took 35, 40 seconds to come through my fax machine. And it's resolved. Everything finished. The courts then accepted the kids did want to see me. And to cut a long story short, they removed all the orders. Kids go where they want. I've had two of my kids living with me continuously ever since. And the middle one who wants to come over and live with me now. Well, she's talking about it. But I'll see her loads anyway.
Amazing. Amazing. Incredible story. Not something that you'd want to wish on anyone.
Oh, no. But
luckily... Luckily, it's resolved for you, unlike a lot of dads who are still fighting to see their kids all over the country.
That's it. You know, my kids had to step outside of this corrupt and farcical court system, which is there meant to be to protect their interests. They didn't. And when the kids took on the courts immediately backed down and gave them what they wanted. But they wanted this for 10 years, but they got to an age where they could take the law into their own hands.
Mm.
And the moment they did, and the little one was only 11 when she did this, she wasn't that old. But once they took the law into their own hands, that was it. Everything was resolved. And the courts got out of our lives and probably continue to wreak havoc in other people's lives now instead of mine.
Mm.
But, yeah, I can laugh about it now, but I didn't laugh at the time when this was going on.
No, no. So, Jolly, you want to tell us a bit about some of the stunts you've pulled for Fathers for Justice? I hear that one of the early ones was... I think you spent 7 days on the Tamar Bridge in sub-zero freezing cold temperatures and then frustrated the police by planning a very clever getaway.
Yeah, it was funny, really, because if you go back to the start before the Tamar, I had briefly heard about Mark and I'd been to a solicitor to find out about my case, the fact that I wouldn't have been allowed to see my own daughter, and they warned me about him and said, keep away from him, he's trouble.
Really?
Yeah, it was the first solicitor I went to see. And of course, I was in the early days, I was a little bit on the fence, a little bit unsure what to do. And I know certainly the first demonstration that Matt, when Fathers for Justice was first formed, he'd asked me to go, it was at 205 Christmases, stormed the Lord Chancellor's Department in London. He asked me to come along and I said, well, actually, I don't want it to spoil my case, so I don't want to get too involved. And this is what all the solicitors I'd spoken to had advised me. Keep out of men's groups. Don't get involved. They're trouble. They'll go against your case.
Mm. And do you think a lot of men heed that advice and therefore don't end up...
Even now, they're getting the same advice all the time. I regularly hear it. They're being told, it will spoil your case. It will spoil your chances of seeing your children.
Mm. And because they love their kids so much, they don't want to take the risk.
They don't want to take the risk, no. But that went on, and of course that was a Christmas demonstration, and then in May I had my so-called final hearing, and I went in there thinking I had absolutely nothing to lose. I was sure I was going to come out with good time with my daughter and all the rest of it, and I was completely humiliated, and I just couldn't believe the crap that I heard in that court that day. And that evening I rang Matt O'Connor up and said, Matt, I'm going to climb up on the court roof tomorrow. And he said, hang on, give me a few days, I'll get a banner sorted out, get some guys down there, and we'll come and support you. And that's exactly what happened. And then I suppose really from there onwards...
Did you have the superhero costume at that stage, or was that just you you on the roof yourself?
I dressed up as Tony Blair, I think, on that first one.
Yeah.
Tony Blair mask, the Prime Minister, obviously.
Yep. And that was on the roof of your own courthouse?
The local court, Plymouth House court, in Plymouth, right. Court. Yeah, Plymouth Court. The one that I'd done Mark over all the years, and it was also starting to ridicule myself. So, but the feedback was so immense. I obviously, you go a bit blind into these things. You don't know what to expect. And the feedback from everybody was just unbelievable. And obviously spurred me on. I realised this was the only way to get the message out. And then I obviously started climbing cranes and bridges and the Royal Courts of Justice. And then it came on to, the Tamar Bridge. And there again, I'd been into court and the judge had made some ridiculous judgment. I can't particularly remember that one, the one instant. It was something probably, I think he'd actually taken a day away because it was, once again, making the mother anxious, my contact with my own daughter. And so I got up on the Tamar Bridge in January and spent a week up there. And it was something like minus 10, I think, wasn't it, up there that week?
It was bad, yeah. I know when you phoned me, I could hardly hear what you were saying because the wind that was howling around you. It was a traditional British winter's evening. Yeah.
But, that judge, just a few days before, had humiliated me so much. I thought, this is my only chance. And right. You get so angry and frustrated. And what can you do? You know, unless you go out and take it out on somebody else or something. You know what I mean? Or
because you've got no legal recourse or legal redress to challenge these horrendous decisions, without it taking months and months. Right, if you want to actually get something done, then
when you get treated with that injustice and you see the corruption that's going on, you're angry, and there's a lot of guys that will go out there and they turn to drink and drugs or whatever.
Yeah, or increasingly, unfortunately, take their own lives Australia. I don't know what it's like over here.
There's plenty that gets brushed under the carpet, so
it's all kept quiet. And I just found the best way for me to take my anger out was to do something like that. So I got up on the bridge and stopped the traffic for a day. And there again, the result came from that. It was amazing, worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I remember I had guys coming down in the middle of the night to say thanks for doing this, shouting up at 2-3 o'clock in the morning and said, I just wanted to come down quietly while nobody was around. Just to say thanks for doing this.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So that it was good. Yeah.
Some of your other stunts, you climbed a crane. You heard that you made friends with a crane driver once, or the operator of the crane once that you climbed. Was that true?
Yeah.
Or he was hostile and then he sort of...
That's right. Well, I went up, they were actually building a new family court. And they had a crane on it, and I thought, well, this is an opportunity not to be missed.
It's poetry.
So I went up there about three, half past three in the morning, and after about three trips up and down, bottle of water, and then your backpack and your banner. It was about half past six in the morning I actually finished getting up there. I was a bit exhausted, and it started getting daylight, and I can't stand heights. And of course, once you can see the distance, I just froze, and I froze the combination of being tired and all the rest of it, and I didn't know what to do. I just froze there, and then a little while later I heard the crane driver coming up, and he got up to the top and obviously says, what do you think you're doing? And I said, well, I'm protesting. Meanwhile, all my stuff is in bags around me, and he said, well, I don't know what you're doing, but you're not doing it on my crane. and that just spurred me on enough to get the banner, and I shuffled along to the end, and we talked a little bit, and then I explained to him what I was doing, and in fact he said in the end, he said, well, actually thinking about it, good on you. And he said I'm going to get paid anyway, stick it up here as long as you possibly can. He said, there's a heater in the cab. He said, I'll open the cab up, but there's a heater in there, I'll put the heater on for you, and there's a radio. He said, they're going to turn the electric off eventually. He said, but, enjoy it while it's there. And they're great. And I got the banner out and I kept it up and stayed up there for about 3 days.
It's fantastic. What a great story.
And funny enough, I came down. The fireman eventually helped me come down. Went down to the police station. And as I was going through the corridor in the police station, there was a Fathers for Justice poster up on their notice board. And I went in there, they made me a cup of coffee, a couple of guys came in and shook my hand, and then they let me out the back door.
And we'll be back with more of Mark Harris and Jolly Stainsby after this short musical interlude.
Empty house, empty life, no family, no wife. I can stay up all night, I can run round in the nude, I can eat steak or any other. I don't have to go and buy her flowers. Don't have to be early, I don't have to be late. I'm Daddy Immaculate. I'm Daddy Immaculate. Come through a Monday, yo. I'm Daddy Immaculate. I'm coming to a Bonnello. Cause I just said her bum looks big in this. Nobody to love, nobody to care, nobody to try and tell me to cut my hair. Nobody to play with, nobody to fight, nobody to keep me warm at night.
Talking with Mark Harris, he's the author of Family Court Hell, and Jolly Stainsby, activist with Fathers for Justice.
You've obviously been arrested a number of times. Have you ever been, have any of the charges ever stuck? Have you ever been imprisoned or fined for any of the protests that you've...
Well, funny, you mentioned the Tamar Bridge, which was for the week. I actually managed to, although there were police there for 24 hours a day, and in fact what they did during the night, they called up, rang my mobile or blew their horn until I showed my face every hour. They said it was because it was cold and they were worried about my health, but I think probably more that they were trying to wear me out. But actually what happened was I actually jumped off the gantry and jumped into a car, a friend's car, which I'd phoned through to, and managed to get away. And
despite them watching you 24/7,
they were sat there watching.
They were still there, weren't they? Yeah, they've gone. Yeah,
they were there blowing their horns, and suddenly you weren't.
I rang the local paper, and I think they rang the police about 3 hours after I got down, and said, "Do you realise that he's down?" I said, "No, he's still up there." And obviously they had to come and check, and I was gone. But after that, I drove up to London, and I came down on the Friday, went to pick my daughter up from school. That's why I came down. And there were police in the school waiting for me. So I did a slight detour, drove up to London. And on the Monday morning, we closed the four main routes into London. And
with other members of Fathers for Justice.
Yeah, four lots of us. And
what were you, blocking the motorways? Or?
Yeah, all the main routes coming into London, just... the whole of London was gridlocked, and that was Monday morning. And anyway, obviously, I knew I was going to get pulled for the Tamar, so I thought I'd do it in style. So. And sure enough, that happened. But coming on to the question that you just asked me, had I ever been done for it? We had a jury trial for that, closing the road down. It took nearly 3 weeks at a trial. On the first trial, they couldn't reach a verdict. So they then did a retrial, which was not quite so long, but it was another couple of weeks, and we were found not guilty on the retrial. They reckoned it cost about £1.5 million, the court case.
That's, for Australian listeners, that's £1.5 million sterling, which is probably something around the order of $4 million Australian dollars.
So, is it more than double, is it now?
Yeah. It's 2.4 or something.
The judge was actually telling the jury that we were guilty, really. But the jury just saw through it, you know. I remember I took in my two suitcases full of court paperwork, which I had during the court case, fighting for my own daughter. I think maybe that's what might have swayed it a little bit, you know. When they realised their taxpayers' money was being spent on that absolute rubbish. Since I've had lots of court cases, the only one I was ever, I think, convicted for was actually, again, another gantry over a motorway. I closed a motorway one Sunday afternoon. And I was told, again on a retrial, on the first trial we found couldn't get a verdict. They said that if I pleaded guilty to a public nuisance, they would give me a conditional discharge and that would be it. I said no, but the three other defendants with me couldn't afford the accommodation for the week's trial, and they wanted to get back to work, and I was advised that I couldn't make a separate plea to the other four, or the other three. And so I went along with it, and that's the only one. I got a £50 fine and a conditional discharge for a year. I refused to pay the fine. They threatened me with all sorts of things, bailiffs, all the rest of it. I refused. And then they just threw it out, all out of court. And that's all I've had. And I think I've done something like 15 stunts so far. And I've got one coming up for handcuffing Margaret Hodge, the children's minister.
The court case is about to come up.
Yeah, that's coming up in September. It'll be a trial again, I think 4 days or 4 parts.
Another jury
trial. Another jury trial, yeah. So we look forward to that.
Yeah. I hear... back in your days in the family court, you once went in dressed up as a woman to make the point that maybe they might treat you a little bit more favourably if you were.
You have been doing your homework, haven't you? I don't normally tell people about that one. What it was, it took me when I was fighting to see my daughter after the ex-partner had stopped me seeing her. It took about 6 weeks to go to court. But in this case, what had happened is my ex-partner actually written to me and said, I'm going to America with a new boyfriend. Would you like to have your daughter for the week I'm away? And I wrote back and said, yeah, of course, that'd be great. I'd love to. And then 2 days before the set time, I got another letter and I've changed my mind. You're not having her. And that weekend, it was my weekend with her anyway. So I just decided to keep her. I thought, well, my daughter was all excited about the week with me. And there was no reason why I shouldn't have her for that week. So I hang on to her. And I was up in London doing a bit of sightseeing. I had a phone call from the police. Your daughter is on a missing children's list. Can you take her to the nearest police station as soon as possible? And to show that she's unharmed. That was the word they used, to show that she's unharmed.
Even though she's with her own father, it's like not like she's been kidnapped by...
Absolutely crazy. And I said, well, obviously I won't be going to the nearest police station, but I said, you're welcome to speak to her if you really want to. And I said, I'll be taking her back to school on Wednesday, as, you know, as I was going. Anyway, I got back from London. I was in the house within half an hour. There was a knock on the door. Two policemen arrived. My daughter was in the bath, singing away, and they came in and said they came to take her away. And I said, well, you won't be taking her out of this house. Anyway, after a little chat and stuff, and they could hear she was happy, they said, well, look, if you get her out of the bath and we can see that she's all right, that she's unharmed again, we'll leave her, but we're not going to say that social services might turn up later on to take her away. And I had a court case the next morning, all set up. Took them 2 days. My ex-partner was still in America on holiday, and I had to go into court because I'd kept her 3 days more than what apparently I should have had her. And so, yes, I dressed up as a woman purely to show that if I was a woman, maybe I could have got to see my daughter in the first place within 2 or 3 days rather than have to last 6 weeks.
Hmm. Maybe you wouldn't have the police checking up on you to see if your own daughter is okay.
Absolutely crazy, crazy. And then what went along with that court case too, in the paperwork that came into court in that morning, the solicitor had said that she was very, the actual wording was, the solicitor was very unhappy that the police hadn't forced her out of my house. Actually used the word forced. I came out of court and I showed that bit of paperwork to the Sun newspaper. It was seen by the solicitor. I was dragged back into court and I was given a 3-month suspended jail sentence.
Because you breached the family court privacy by showing...
Because I breached the secrecy of the family courts and showed them that one little paragraph. How dare a solicitor say that the child should be forced, a 5-year-old little girl...
Forced by police from the bathtub
out
of the house. It's just unbelievable.
3 months suspended jail sentence. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I thought things were bad in Australia, but it sounds like the UK... Family courts.
I think we lead the way in bad courts. Yeah, I think
Britain leads the way. You've got the Monty Python of family courts.
Yeah, we lead; the others are followed. Yeah,
it's just crazy. I mean, the way they make you feel. You know what I mean? I mean, I was so angry that, how dare they say they should force her out of my house? But yet, you know, anybody'd want to show somebody that, and yet they make you feel so humiliated and bad that you've done such a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And yet it's them that are doing the terrible thing. They're the ones that need to be humiliated. They're the ones that need to be shown up for what they're really doing.
But also, how can it be a contempt of court? Because the judge is a public person, and you want to show a national media source what a public person who's paid for by the public purse, what he's up to. You're not trying to identify the mum or the kids. You're trying to show what the public servant has said. And or the same with the solicitors, they're funded like legal aid, all publicly funded.
Paid by the taxpayer.
Yeah, it's all public funds, and they're all public servants. Why can't we show what these people do?
Right, so the public knows where their money's being spent.
What they're paying for, exactly. We can understand it if you shouldn't identify the kids and the mum, that's fair enough, and yourself, that's fine, but we shouldn't be stopped from identifying the judges and all the court players, because they are funded publicly, almost always. Legal aid, judges are paid though.
And we're in a democracy, and so almost any other part of a democracy, people are held accountable for their actions, and so why should that not apply to the most fundamental heart of a democracy, which is the family, people and their children? It's absolutely insane.
Every other branch of the court service is open to public accountability. You can sue someone for a minor traffic accident, and that's all open to the public. You can see how the judge deals with it, how the solicitors deal with it. Criminal cases are all open to the public. They protect the identity of minors in all those cases, but then when it comes to the family courts, the doors are shut, bolted and barred, and it all goes on in secret.
And we'll be back with more of Mark and Jolly after this short break.
would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Just wanna get by with my friend. Once in a while, but how do I feel at the end of the day?
Are you sad because you're on your own?
I try not to get sad.
Talking with Mark Harris. He's the author of a new book, Family Court Hell, and also Jolly Stainsby, activist with Fathers for Justice.
In the period that the both of you have been involved in protests and in action trying to reform this crazy system, have you actually seen any change on behalf of legal change or even hints by politicians that they might want to do something to change the culture? Have you seen any progress?
Well, yeah, I think from years ago that it was everyone thought the court system must be right. It's our British court legal system. It must be right. Now there is a general feeling that the courts don't work. The family courts don't work. The family courts are a farce. They're an injustice. They shouldn't be in secret. There is a general public perception that it's very, very ill, the family legal system. Actual change, I don't think there's been any change from within from the legal system. But I think there's a general acceptance now that the fact from public and people around the very edges of the sort of legal system, people have been involved in family courts, that there is something drastically wrong with it. And we're getting the odd MP who comes forward and says that the courts are wrong, they're not doing their job, they're harming children, and they're not being fair. But as for actual change, I don't personally think there's been any at this moment in time.
Mm, but hopefully there's just a bit of of lag behind.
That's it, the lead first.
The public opinion probably always comes first. And
that's
then,
it,
I mean, politics and the law, they're incredibly slow-moving institutions.
So. And also, it's a multi-billion pound industry. The people working in the family court system, the barristers, solicitors, judges, child psychiatrists, they're earning a very lucrative living out of what's going on. They don't want change, so they're going to drag their heels. They're going to be dragged kicking and screaming to change. But you've got this great big public opinion in Britain, at least, that it's obviously something wrong with it, even if you don't know much about it, that it's not working. Everyone's criticising. All these people can't be telling us lies, that there's something wrong with this. And as I said, the change will come, I think, but I think it'll be slow. But the actual legal change, no, nothing's happened just yet.
Mm.
But it is an industry, and this is the trouble. If it was to change tomorrow, there'd be, millions of people out of work.
Yeah,
millions of people. People don't realise that the people that are involved from obviously you've got your solicitors, your barristers, your judges, all your courts and that are run, police, a lot of police work, social services work, court reporting, even things like bailiffs and stuff. I mean, the amount of bailiffs and that have been around my house, and there's, of course, the Child Support Agency. They're all making a living out of it.
It's an unseen industry. Yeah, if you go down a factory estate, you'll see factories that make televisions, make cars, etc. This is a massive industry you don't see. They've got very anonymous offices in the average high street. You have a row of shops, little tiny office in the middle, solicitor's office. And if you read very carefully on the front shop, the shop front, you'll see that all the litigation they do, criminal work and civil litigation and family work or children act stuff, will be squeezed in amongst the words. But it's invisible. You've got to go and look for it. You won't just see it. And there's all these people, they're not in uniforms or nothing, they don't drive cars that are marked, they're all just busy going about their industry, and you don't see it. You don't see it, it's an invisible industry. You could pass solicitors and barristers in the street, and you wouldn't know you've done it. You go past these offices, you don't know you've gone past them. It's an invisible industry.
Mm. But it's probably, in dollar terms, a lot bigger than the huge brand name corporations that we all know of as industry.
Oh, yeah. Family court work in the courts is...
Three quarters of litigation every day in family courts in Britain.
Is
in civil family. Courts, it's family stuff.
Family breakup.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then don't forget, you've got things like psychologists and psychiatrists, and they all get involved. See, they're all having a pick in.
Mm.
There's a real wide range of characters in there that are making big money out of it.
Mm. And out of removing children from either one parent or occasionally both parents.
Yeah.
And the children will become, wards of the state. Is that the term you use here?
Well, there is that water court, they call it here.
Right, but in any case, it's all about the breaking up of
families. Breaking up families.
In order to make money.
If you can keep mum and dad going to court, there's an awful lot of people making an awful lot of money, an awful lot of good livings out of watching that go on and taking part. If the system was fair, it would resolve quick. Because the system is unfair, dad can spend years, like I did, 10 years, chasing the kids all the time, trying to get to the kids. And, of course, mum's trying to defend her thoughts and position. And all the people sat around and making a lot of money while you're tearing each other apart, trying to fight over the kids.
Mm.
And the kids suffer most out of it all, definitely.
Right. Mm. Not only the family conflict, but the fact that both mum and dad, a vast amount of their income is going on...
It's not going to affect...
Going into this industry.
It affects your finances, it affects your health, it affects any subsequent relationships, it affects everything.
Mm. And yet the mantra of the courts is that we're doing it always in the best interests of the children, right?
No, that's a lie.
And the bizarre thing is, over all these years, they've never, ever kept any records. So they don't actually know what the outcomes are of all these children that have gone through these courts. They've got no feedback whatsoever. They've got no records of children over the last few years. So they don't know. All they do know is that the people that are ending up in our prisons, people that are committing teenage crime and the teenage pregnancies, most of these, something like 72% or something, come from broken families and foster homes. So they're realising now that the outcome is...
There's a realisation with all the gang culture you've got in the big cities in Britain, like London and Birmingham, where there's shootouts on the streets these days. It's all kept pretty much out of the press, but you do hear about it. And it's the gang culture. They all come from fatherless homes. The social experiment of the single parents and the alternative families hasn't worked. And of course, now there's this monumental mess created. You've got a couple of generations of young men, especially, not having any aspirations to have families, get married, and sort of build a life. They just join the gangs and run with the hounds. And I think we're all paying a price for that now, really, socially.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah.
Big time. Yeah.
Jolly and Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program today. Mark Harris's book, Family Court Hell, is available through amazon.co.uk if you want to order that over the web.
And if I could just say a little bit about the book, that within secret family courts, it's illegal in this country to go inside a court and talk or make reference to what went on in the proceedings. You can only talk about the result, like you've got a contact order, you haven't. My case is quite unique in British legal history. It's the only case known in Britain where I've actually been able to go into the court, talk about all the people that did this, name and shame them, which I have done in graphic detail, and expose just what happened in my particular case. And as I said, it went on for 133 hearings before 33 judges. I think you get a good flavour from reading this as to how the courts operate, what they actually do in all these other cases that can't be talked about.
Mm. So it really is a rare and unique window into the family court system.
Yeah, it's the first time anyone can legally publish this, and if I couldn't, they would have stopped it by now, but they can't stop it. It's actually gone out there, and I've been out of a name and shame, and my oldest daughter has actually done a chapter in the book about a child's perspective when she was all those years of wanting to see her dad, and no one wanted to listen until she took the law into her own hands, and of course they all walked away.
Mm.
But it is the only case that you can go in and legally talk about everything that happened. We've found a way of doing that, and we've done it, and I'm hoping it helps bring a little bit of change eventually.
Mm. Look, I'm sure it will. If anything is going to, then this is, you know, this is a big step.
It's another step. Yeah, it's another step. Yeah, we still need people climbing on things with banners, still making a public fuss, still handcuffing themselves to ministers, still sort of doing all the things they do. But
chasing,
I'm hoping,
the Queen's carriage, yeah, dressed in their underpants.
Exactly. Yeah,
I believe that was you, Jolly.
That's it. Yeah, Batman.
Okay,
Batman on whatever he wants to climb on. All those things is needed as well. But this book, as I said, does give a little bit of insight as to what actually goes on in the court. This is why they're doing it. This is why they're climbing on things. Because most people can't talk about what's happened to them.
Right. And do you have a website for Fathers for Justice that people can go to if they want to find out a bit more?
You can go on www.fathers-4, that's the figure 4, justice.org. That should find your website.
Yeah.
But if you just put on the search engine, Fathers for Justice, you'll eventually find it that way. Yeah, just put on the search engine if you can't remember that, and Fathers for Justice.
But there are quite a few copycat organisations coming out now, so you want to make sure you get the right one.
When you do Fathers for Justice, use the figure 4, not the word F-O-R 4.
Right.
The figure 4 is important. That will bring up the right people.
Okay, and we'll be putting all the details of the websites and details of Mark's book on our website as well, so you can... And that's www.dadsontheair.net. So once again, Mark and Jolly, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the program, and all the best for the future.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Cheers.
Okay, cheers.
If you'd like to buy a copy of Mark Harris's book, Family Court Hell, a limited number of copies are available from our website. That's www.dadsontheair.net. They're available for just $19.95, and that includes shipping anywhere in Australia. So it's a great deal. Go to our website, just click on the new bookstore tab, and you can pay by credit card, and we'll ship that off to you.
Well, that was a great interview with Mark Harris and Jolly Stainsby. Excellent work there by Greg Anderson, the interviewer. As we said, if you want to listen to that again, you can go to www.dadsontheair.net. Just a short note on the suicide research that's going on at the moment with the Australian Institute for Suicide Research and Prevention. If you want to be involved, they're urgently seeking men who have just separated in the last 12 months. You can ring them on 073 735 3338. I'll repeat that, 073 735 3338. They're looking for people who have separated in the last 12 months. Please get involved. That's the Australian Institute for Suicide Research and Prevention. We'll be back next week.